Hello and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of arts and culture. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe, and today my guests will be Amy Mueller, director of the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, also organist Cameron Carpenter, who will improvise the score to Eisenstein's silent movie Battleship Potemkin at Davies Symphony Hall this weekend. I'll be speaking with Tony Award-winning actor Wilson Heredia, who is appearing as Lancelot in a new production of Camelot at San Francisco Playhouse. And book critic and regular contributor Peter Robinson tells us about his favorite paperbacks for summer. All this during the next hour here on Open Air. My special guest here in the studio is Cameron Carpenter. It's wonderful to see you. Welcome to KALW.
Thank you so much. My great pleasure.
I was just on your website listening to your Chopin Etudes played on organ. That's an incredible feat.
Thank you.
Really dazzling.
Thank you.
You're in town to perform, to improvise a score for the 1925 silent film Battleship Potemkin.
That's right.
By Sergei Eisenstein. It's at Davies Hall here in San Francisco this coming Sunday at 7:30. I'd like to ask you about improvisation, first of all. You were trained, classically trained. You play Bach and Chopin and Schubert. You have several CDs out. And you also compose. We'll be hearing that in a minute. But improvisation is such a different thing, and I always think people either read the notes on the page or improvise, but you do both. How did you do it from an early age?
Certainly I did, yes. I mean, improvisation for me was my immediate and remains my core attachment to musical life in general, from which everything else extends. So while I totally agree with you that there are a lot of people for whom music is a fixed entity, that is not the case for me. And I think that's one of the reasons I consider myself sort of a, you might say somehow, a post-romantic composer, musical personality rather, in the sense that everything derives from the idea of the performance of this abstract thing which is going on inside of me psychologically somehow, and for which music is in more or less different ways, depending on the work and the context, a medium for an expression of that thing, which is rather unlike somebody who's performing a text, although that may also be just as valid.
It's interesting, post-romantic, but also, I mean, we think of organists in Bach's time. Baroque organists did a lot of improvisation, which people have gotten out of the habit of doing, I think.
Well, I suppose that the last two vestiges of improvisation officially are jazz and the organ. Although the organ's domain, as far as improvisation goes, while it has been a wild and wondrous, you know, incredibly diverse one, is nevertheless generally somehow tied to church. And, you know, again, to talk about vestiges, the expectation that's attached to that can be seen sometimes in the way in which people expect automatically that any improvisation done on the organ will have a theme. This is one of the reasons that filmic improvisation, while also limited by certain aspects of, you know, what we're also seeing, is very interesting to me, because it allows you to depart from the literality of a necessarily a given musical theme that has to be maintained, and yet you're still guided by the limitations of what you're seeing and what you're serving musically, visually.
Mm.
So it's a great thing. I mean, improvisation in its ideal is not a total liberation from limitation, but rather an adaptation to those limitations within which an expression can be achieved, sometimes that's in its own way greater than without those limitations.
Interesting. Interesting. Your website is CameronCarpenter.com, and let's listen to you. This is a cadenza from one of your albums. Is this an improvisation?
It is. Well, what you'll hear is, what we'll cue up is the last 30 seconds or so of the great fugue in G major by Johann Sebastian Bach, one of the so-called seminal organ works. And this, unlike many of his works, has this dramatic pause where Bach has notated a fermata, which is the musical indication to stop and wait, on this unbelievably intense chord, something that's right out of the 56th Cantata or the St. Matthew Passion, one of the ultimate chords of unresolved tension in all of Bach, and one of those chords that foreshadow all of the German Romantic composers who would come hundreds of years later. And then the music, after a slight rest, simply continues in its previous style and comes to a logical resolution, which I found incredibly interesting. And in the idea that there was this fermata followed by this tiny rest, I somehow could never get over the feeling in the performance of this work that we were skipping over a little gateway to a completely different dimension there, into which Bach quite possibly himself may have gone zooming off. And it's what you'll hear now is that Bach, then followed by my improvisation, which explores the idea of going off into this gateway, which ultimately returns us back to the notated musical language and Bach's own notated end, played more or less as written.
Great. Cameron Carpenter. That's organist Cameron Carpenter from his Telex CD, Cameron Live, the CD, and an improvised cadenza. You get some of the Pasicali in there in the bass line, right?
Yeah, actually, there are a number of themes in there that are coming from some of the other Bach works on the album and some of the other Bach works, you know, in general.
So let's talk about your appearance this Sunday at 7:30 at Davies Symphony Hall. You're improvising to Battleship Potemkin, 1925 silent film by Sergei Eisenstein, Davies Symphony Hall. So let's talk a little bit about how you do this. The film is playing on the screen. Where are you in relation to the screen?
I'll be on the stage playing the mobile organ console, which will be situated in front of the screen. I'll have on that console a small screen playing in sync the film with time code. And so the way it works basically is that I know the film, although this is the first public performance I'll ever give of it, actually. And for the most part, the score will be improvised. I'm considering using Bach, part of Bach's 56th Cantata, which is socially relevant to this film because it's the cantata in which Bach is speaking through the words of an unknown poet of carrying the cross. I will my cross staff gladly bear, which to me is, of course, readable as allegory for the entire struggle, which is embodied in communist terms in the film, but which is readable, I think, in terms of in sort of a broader social sense. And also it's the cantata which has the famous bass aria of crossing the waters safely.
Ah. So you mentioned mobile organ console. That's what you're playing on stage. So
that's right.
Describe that to the audience.
Well, as anybody will see or have seen if they go or have gone to Disney Hall, to Davies Hall, actually it's true at Disney Hall as well, the organ, however imposing at the back of the stage, is controlled by what amounts to a set of keyboards in what we call a console, which can be plugged in. It's electrically connected to the organ and can be positioned anywhere on the stage, which is unlike and a great improvement upon a great number of the organs of antiquity, in which the architecture of the organ so hates the idea of a personality at the center of it that the organist is literally obscured from view. Not, thankfully, the case at Davies Hall. And it's also very handy in this case because I'm almost part of the audience. I'm able to hear what they're hearing, which is another great advantage over being located inside the organ.
See, that's an interesting thing because people like to look at you because you're often dressed in really, you know, amazing outfits.
Thank you.
You're wearing these teddy bear shoes that are sort of neon colors right now, and so
they're the only shoes that I figured would have enough power to make it through radio visually.
Well, is this unusual for you to kind of blend into the audience as opposed to being out there as a performer?
Well, yes. I probably find it pretty difficult to blend into anything, but I shouldn't say. I mean, I may have overstated being part of the audience, since obviously I'm on the stage. But obviously, one of the things that one wants as a performer, well, at least what I want, is to be as close to my audience as possible. And one of the great paradoxes of the organ, and one which I'm attempting to severely controvert, is that idea that the performer should be distant and somehow removed, not just physically, but maybe in some even more sinister, unstated way.
How much do you work out ahead of time? Do you not work out anything ahead of time? You say you're using some sort of excerpts from Bach, perhaps.
And possibly from a major organ concerto by Josef Jongen, which has one of the most terrifying and glorious last movements, which I've arranged for organ alone, and which I will time for the dramatic ending of the film, which, spoiler, I won't give you. But the music, as they say, it's always inside me. And it's quite possible for me to sit and play in a drop-the-needle sort of fashion the music which accounts for the bulk of my what may seem like mental distraction at any time. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite possible then to just tap into that and ideally to utilize it, to fit it into the context of the film in some appropriate way. This film is particularly wonderful because, unlike a lot of silent film, which is difficult for us to see in the visual context of today without the aspect of camp, for instance, the Eisenstein is such a visionary director, and this film is of such a serious and socially relevant material that specifically the rejection of political repression, that it's quite easy to take it perfectly seriously as is, and therefore my musical efforts can be based on the film and be devoted to serving it rather than making the film work and be watchable.
Right. Wonderful. Again, your website is CameronCarpenter.com, so we can find out about upcoming appearances, including, I think, Concerto written for you by Terry Riley.
Quite so, yes.
That's exciting. Battleship Potemkin is this Sunday, 7:30 p.m. at Davies Symphony Hall. I think there's information at sfsymphony.org. Perhaps.
There is.
So thank you so much, Cameron
Carpenter.
Thank you.
So much a pleasure for me.
Thank you. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulipe, and thanks very much to Eric Jansen and to Neil Swinkles for this afternoon's show. My guest coming up, Amy Mueller, will go out with some of Cameron Carpenter performing Bach. Cameron Carpenter from his album Cameron Live on the Teldec label. You're listening to Open Air, weekly cultural arts on KALW. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe. And again, special thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and engineer Eric Jansen for today's show. Amy Mueller, it's great to see you. You're artistic director of the Playwrights Foundation. And also here, playwright Kimber Lee will be talking about the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. So now in its second weekend coming up, right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, great. It's amazing how long this has been going on. This is the 36th year?
Yes, that is correct. It was started in the 70s, the late 70s, by Robert Woodruff, who's an internationally famous director now. And on that very first festival, he really wanted to find a venue for some of the young writers coming up, and one of them was Sam Shepard. Back in the day.
Yeah. Mm. And many of the playwrights have gone on to really successful careers.
Yes, they have. Yeah. In part due to our efforts, and then there are many other play development labs across the country. Not many other, a handful, who do similar kind of work and allow writers to develop their work and their careers.
And we should mention it's at the Thick House Theater, which is 1695 18th Street here in San Francisco,
right.
1695 18th Street. So you choose six new works from almost 500 submissions.
Yes.
What is that process like? What are you looking for?
We're looking for a unique voice. We're looking for a singular voice and writers who are, for the most part, are just emerging into their careers and on the scene, who have an exceptional artistic aesthetic, who are pushing the boundaries of the form, who are telling stories that are important. Those are the kinds of writers we're looking for.
Yeah. And one of the playwrights for this coming weekend is here now, Kimber Lee. Great to see you.
Hello.
The name of your play is Brownsville Song, B-Side for Trey. Is that right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about when did you write this play?
This play was written in October and November of 2012, so just last fall.
And you live in New York?
I do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what has been the process of coming to the Playwrights Festival? You rehearse, do you rewrite, do you work with the performers on your work?
Yeah, there's a little bit of all of that. I think one of the things about being a playwright is that it can be a very isolated activity when you're creating work. So things such as the Bay Area Playwrights Festival become really crucial at a certain stage for a playwright to be able to experience their work with a team of creative artists who can help you kind of navigate what steps you want to take with it. And sometimes, you know, being able to get out to another city as well and meet a new community of theater artists is really crucial because it gives you a really fresh perspective on the work that you're doing.
Mm.
Yeah.
And this play is about a Brooklyn family, is that right?
Yeah, it's set in a particular neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York called Brownsville, and is just kind of about a family and the experience of loss.
Oh. Yeah. Interesting. So, Amy, this weekend, let's just talk about the weekend. There are various things. There's a Young Theater Makers Showcase. Mm-hmm. There's sort of feedback from the audience. Tell us about what is in store for the weekend.
Okay. Tomorrow, I'm going to start with tomorrow afternoon. In addition to this, working on the six plays, we often like to bring the community together in a kind of conversation about issues that are coming up in the work that we've noticed across the field. And this year, we're hosting a symposium, almost like a summit, 3 hours tomorrow afternoon. It's free, and it's called "Making Theater in a Messed Up World."
Mm.
And we've got. I've invited some veteran theater makers and some very young new theater makers to come together in a kind of cross-generational conversation. Kimber's going to be there, as well as Richard Montoya from Culture Clash is coming up from L.A. Rodessa Jones will be there, Joan Holden, Christine Young from USF, and a host of other people. It will be moderated by the Mime Troupe's Valina Brown. And we're going to be talking about why and how artists make a choice to devote their artistic lives to talking about social justice issues and issues of the community. And then we're going to be talking about the transformation of so-called political theater in the 21st century. And Javier Reyes is going to be here from Colored Ink. Ryan Nicole Peters, who is with a troupe called New Decades, is going to be and works mostly in the hip-hop genre, is going to be there, as well as a bunch of other people to kind of talk about that.
So we're sounds gonna, exciting.
It is, yeah. And then we're going to jump into Brownsville that evening, on Friday evening.
So this is... And there's something tonight, too? Is that true?
We're actually have postponed the Young Theater Maker Showcase for another time.
So it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, pretty much all day. You're a busy woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know you have kids, so that must be a lot to be away from your family. And all the information and schedule is probably at playwrightsfoundation.org.
That's right.
Playwrights, plural, foundation.org. And this happens at Thick House, which is 1695 18th Street. Mm-hmm. Is it near a BART station?
It's not near a BART station, but you can get there on the 19 or the 10 or the 22 Fillmore. I'll take you very close, in close proximity.
So this festival really gives a range of ages and also sort of careers from emerging playwrights to established.
Yeah.
Gets everybody together, and it sounds like the event tomorrow really gets everyone in one room and talking about all these important issues.
Right.
Yeah.
And yes. And so we have this sort of colloquium. It's going to be broadcast live on New Play TV. Mm. It's hashtag New Play TV. And over the weekend, we're also on Saturday, because we three of our six writers are from the Asian American community. Two of them are actually Korean Americans, and one is a Thai American. And the plays, in some way or another, reflect that in various ways. So tomorrow we're doing a whole day called Asian Voices in American Theater.
Mm.
And so the morning people can come for free again to hear Asian American theater artists talking about what's happening in the Asian American theater world at large. Then we're going to see Jihei Park's Hannah and the Dread Gazebo, which takes place in Korea. And in the DMZ and in an imaginary time and space. It's a brilliant, brilliant play by a very young writer as well. After that, we have someone coming to talk about Asian ghosts in American theater over lunch. And there's a very hip a restaurant called Fuse Box.
Oh, in Ellen Chang, of course.
Ellen Chang's, Sebastian Chang's, and her husband, Soon-hee. Own it. It's in West Oakland. And they're going to be providing box lunches.
Oh, fabulous restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then we're going to be watching Prince Gomolvius' new play called... I'm sorry. I just blanked out.
The Brothers Paranormal.
Thank you.
A lot of information in your head.
A lot of ghosts.
Going on.
Brothers Paranormal. Yes.
And PlayrightsFoundation.org is the website. PlayrightsFoundation.org. All at the Thick House here in San Francisco. And Kimberly, in your experience as a young playwright, is this unusual, this kind of coming together of so much talent and energy?
You know, I've been to some types of development conferences around the country. I think everyone is unique to the community that it's in, and it's something that I love to see is, the Bay Area Playwrights Festival really reflects, I think, the personality of the Bay Area and the community that lives here, and it's been a real privilege to be invited to be a part of that for the term of the festival and to get to know the Bay Area theater artists. So I'm the community that has come out thus far to the first weekend of readings has been wonderful, and it's been amazing to hear people's thoughts on the work that they're seeing and the way that they're engaging with the festival. So yeah,
great. So three of the playwrights in this festival are from the Bay Area. Three are from elsewhere?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Laura Shellhart's from Chicago. And then both Kimber and Jihei are from New York.
Amy, what's your own background in theater?
Well, I started back in the day. I'm a theater director. I've directed all over the country and locally in the Bay Area. I think a lot of people know me because many, many years ago I directed Tony Pellegrino's Dear Rose, which people remember pretty well. And then years later at Berkeley Rep, I directed Tanya Schaefer's play about going to Africa. Let My Enemy Live Long, that's the name of it. And then most recently I directed Marcus Gardley's and Jesus Moonwalks the Mississippi. So that's kind of where I come from. I've been the artistic director of Playwrights Foundation for 13 years. Mm. And so I have really devoted myself to the development of new American theater for my entire career. Yeah. I've worked with lots and lots of young, upcoming playwrights and veterans.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Amy Schumer and Kimberly. Again, the website for more information, playwrightsfoundation.org. It's all day, tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
That's right.
At the Thick House, 1695 18th Street here in San Francisco. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's true. It's true. The Crown has made it clear. The climate must be perfect. All the year, a law was made a distant moon ago here. July and August cannot be too hot, and there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot. The winter is forbidden till December, and exits March the 2nd on the dot. By order, summer lingers through September in Camelot. Camelot, Camelot, I know it sounds a bit bizarre, but in Camelot, Camelot, that's how conditions are. The rain may never fall till after sundown. By 8, the morning fog must disappear. In short, there's simply not a more congenial spot for happily ever aftering than
and here in Camelot.
And that is Robert Goulet, I think. Robert Goulet from Camelot. We just jump in there. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulippe this afternoon on Open Air here on KALW San Francisco. And my next guest is Wilson Germain Heredia. Is
yes,
that right?
That's it. Correct.
Tony Award-winning actor. That must feel good.
Yes, yes. It's actually it's great. On my regular days, though, it feels I can't tell the difference.
But it must have. I mean, everybody must ask you. It must have changed your life for your work in Rent and very, very moving portrayal. I didn't see the Broadway production, but the movie just. I mean, amazing work of you as Angel, the drag queen dying of AIDS.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, it changed my life completely, completely in every single way, socially, monetarily, as far as work. But most importantly, I prefer to mention and what affected me the most is that we, that show and that character being in the forefront, What it did was it made people a lot more aware and a lot more tolerant, and I'd like to say that it opened up the floodgates for those kind of roles to be a lot more commonplace, which now they are,
mm-hmm.
Instrumental even, where instrumental in the overturning of Prop 8. That I believe that those beginnings, you know, as little as they are. That to me is a lot more humbling and moving. That's what it really did. Aside from the accolades and the attention, being instrumental in that is something a true accomplishment.
Ah, that's a very powerful thing to do.
Yeah.
You are in Camelot.
Yes, Camelot.
That's a very different thing to be doing. The Lerner and Lowe musical. Currently in production at the San Francisco Playhouse.
Yes.
Through September 14th.
Yes.
And this is an unusual production of Camelot, directed by Bill English.
Yes.
After My Fair Lady, I think, last year, was very successful. And so this is, tell us a little bit about what makes this different and what makes your Lancelot so different.
I like to use that catchphrase, it's an action musical. One, because there is a lot of action. During the rescue and escape segments where they're singing Guinevere. From what I understood in previous productions, that was actually done in the background, or it was just sort of hinted that's what was going on. Even the jousts themselves, but we actually have choreographed fights where it's all in your face, and it's actually quite dangerous. It can be dangerous, and that's the one thing. But the most important thing, that what makes it different from other productions, from what I understand, is that we don't gloss over the actual material at all. C'est moi, and the character itself, that song's people will just assume that it's just about arrogance and it's just about self-adulation, but it's not. It's when you look at the actual lyrics and within the context of the show, what he's trying to say is, and the way that Bill, the direction that he wanted to take along with the whole show is, it's about him wanting to be put in the game. You know, he's a player that has worked his whole life to get to a certain point where he feels that he needs to be important for something greater than him. And so it's more about the faith that he has in himself and how much of service he can be to Camelot and to King Arthur. And the approach that Bill English has taken to the show in general, it's gritty. It's a lot grittier. Guinevere is grittier and a lot more mischievous than portrayed in the past. And also the subtext and the real meat of the whole thing. It centers around the way Bill likes to put it, passionate mania, where it's an observation of what faith can do to a people, to a group of people, the upside and the downside of faith, the upside of believing in something with fervor, and the downside of what can happen as well. Because the scary thing about faith is that it sometimes gives people, many a times, it gives people a lack of culpability for what they're doing. In the name of what they're believing in.
Yeah, explain what you mean by that.
Lance, the concept of chivalry was introduced by Arthur and Lancelot, more by Arthur. Prior to that, the way that the show starts, it's a lot more barbaric, a lot more Viking, and so Arthur wants to change all this. And he has someone, he has an acolyte like me that wants to do things, you know, fight for right, right for right, and so everyone, so the knights are not in accord with this. They don't want to do this, and because of his faith in this concept Camelot. He gives Lancelot gives everything to this man, but then he's conflicted with this love that he has for Guinevere, and love is a form of faith, and what you do for it as well. So he was willing to do anything for that concept of faith because he felt that he was doing the right thing because he was just following his heart. Hmm. And that's what you do when you follow your faith, you follow your heart. That the upside is Camelot was for a brief period was created, and this concept of chivalry was established, and yet that same concept destroyed it. That same concept destroyed that Camelot because of faith. So it's the upside and the downside. And you know, again, no culpability. It leaves you with no culpability. It was like, well, I'm just following my heart. You know, it doesn't matter how many people I kill. It doesn't matter like what happened in order to get to this place.
Right, which is sort of what the Crusades were all about.
Exactly.
In a way,
yeah. Exactly.
Let's listen to a little bit of music, Camelot. Again, we don't have your voice.
I'll sing along with it. No.
Yeah. Okay.
Camelot, in far off France I heard your call. Camelot, and here am I to give my all. I know in my soul what you expect of me, and all that and more I shall be. A knight of the Table Round should be invincible, succeed when a less fantastic man would fail. Climb a wall, no one else can climb.
Wilson Germain Heredia here in the studio. With singing along with Robert Goulet,
yes,
in that recording of Camelot. So I guess for people like me who still have my old record of the original production and the original songbook and stuff, I mean, are people going to get upset by coming to this reworking of Camelot?
I don't think so. I think that the one thing that we still are true to is the material as far as lyrically and melodically. Johnny, who Moreno, who plays Arthur, and Monique Haffen, she's just insane singer, insane actress, and so is and Johnny is just insanely talented. And so, whatever anyone is used to, or what they're accustomed to and expecting, they'll be pleasantly surprised, and they'll soon forget those and have more of this show in the forefront. I believe so, because you're taken in by the drama, definitely by the drama in it. And night after night, we see the scenes that are really, really dramatic. You can hear the audience gasping. So it's a testament to the fact that they're really caught into the show.
We should mention this is at the San Francisco Playhouse.
Yes.
I hear this is a really great new venue, 450 Post Street.
Yes.
A new venue. It's been there for a while. 450 Post Street, the second floor of Kensington Park Hotel between Powell and Mason. And the website is sfplayhouse.org, sfplayhouse.org. Camelot through September 14th. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 7 p.m., Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m., plus Saturdays at 3 p.m. Lots of work for you.
Yes, that's
pretty
nature
intense.
The nature of theater, the nature of musical theater.
You moved to the Bay Area when you did the movie of Rent.
I lived here just temporarily when I was shooting the film here. But I knew 8 years ago when I first came here that I was somehow that I was going to end up here as a resident, because I fell in love with the people, the food, the ambience, the artistry, and you know, I listened to the universe, and the universe gave me an opportunity and said, like, are you ready? And I said, yeah, I'm definitely ready. And I took the opportunity. Here I am.
And you're originally from New York.
Originally from New York, Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
And again, sfplayhouse.org is the website about this production of Rent. It seems like this production is diverging from the original that we know, which is already sort of problematic. It's a problematic musical, which is why maybe it we don't see a lot of it.
Yeah.
But also, in a way, it's more faithful to the original, because didn't Bill English go and get two songs?
Yes.
Fie
on Goodness.
Excuse me?
Fie on Goodness.
So tell us about why the two songs are in this production.
It makes more sense to how he, as he said, how he massaged the script. Felt that in the direction that we were going, that it was necessary, and just the rhythm of the show and the numbers itself, it was just more appropriate, and what happens directly after the song "Fie on Goodness," but it gives you that same concept that I was telling you about the dissension among the ranks of the knights. This is actually, it was their opportunity to say, like, we don't want to do this. We don't want to be chivalrous. We want to raid Scotland. We want to go into Ireland. We want to conquer everything. And it's, you know, completely contrary to what Arthur is trying to establish. And Lancelot helps kind of destroy all that chivalry and that whole concept, because it creates a dissension set, because Modred plants the seed and said, like, well, you know, the king can't even, you know, keep order in his own house. So how can he keep order over his own country? So and that within itself is a belief system that let's just go back to paganism. Let's go back to barbarianism and creates two factions, you know, and both of them, as far as they're concerned, they're right. Both sides are. So that's what it was included. It works a lot more dramatically, and the songs are great as well.
And you get to sing "If Ever I Would Leave You."
Yeah, if ever I, yes. That, if ever I would
that,
leave you, love that.
That must be beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Wilson Heredia. Thank you for coming in and talking about Camelot again. It's sfplayhouse.org is the website. San Francisco Playhouse, 450 Post Street, which is the second floor of the Kensington Park Hotel between Powell and Mason. That must be so nice. The phone number is 415-677-9596. 677-9596. Let's listen to one other. If Ever I Would Leave You.
Yes.
Ah, great.
Seems to be the number that people remember the most.
fertilized.
If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer. Seeing you in summer, I never would go. Your hair streaked with sunlight, your lips red as flame, your face with a luster that puts gold to shame. But if I'd ever leave you, how could it be in autumn? How I'd leave in autumn, I never would know. I've seen how you sparkle when fall nips the air. I know you in autumn, and I must be there. And could I leave you running merrily through the snow? Or on a wintry evening when you catch the fire's glow? If ever I would leave you, how could it be in springtime? Knowing how in spring I'm bewitched by you.
Robert Goulet singing If Ever I Would Leave You from Camelot. You're listening to Open Air here on KALW. I'm Sarah Cahill filling in for David LaTulipe, who will be back, I believe, next week. Peter Robinson is here in the studio to tell us about the best paperbacks for summer, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Paperback writer!
Hi, Sarah. Good to be here. And I'm just smiling when I hear Camelot. It's not a paperback writer or paperback reader, but I reflect on the poems by Tennyson, which actually was based on the legend of King Arthur and the Knights. And in true Victorian style, since they were speaking about chivalry, and that includes decorum, the Victorians couldn't use the word moustache, so Lancelot has a fringe of hair above the upper lip.
Why couldn't they use the word moustache?
Well, I think it was part of this Victorian etiquette. You know, even if you went to a piano recital, the legs on the piano would be covered.
Seems so arbitrary. Moustaches and piano legs aren't acceptable.
I know, they aren't obscene, yeah. Although the legs below could be. But I smile about it just in terms of how one has moved in this instance from poetry, classic Victorian poetry, to contemporary Broadway musical.
Right, and that they used the Once and Future King, right, for the...
For the title, and now we have another George on the way or nominated. Mm. But thinking back to paperbacks, and I should say that I've spent, I did an estimate the other day, about two-thirds of my life in libraries, whether it's the Wooden Carols at Oxford or the fully electronic gadgetry at Google. And I certainly endorse the Mark Twain observation that the man who does not read a good book has no advantage over the man who cannot read. And if I'm traveling, I still pack a couple of paperbacks either in my pocket or in the backpack. And I say that because I have a totally unconfirmed theory about reading. I don't carry an electronic reader, a Nook or an e-book. I find as a journalist these are useful if you want to get quick facts, the times of trains, the times of planes, if you're reading a press release. But this unproven theory I have about reading is that the words come off the page, they go up your arm, into your head, and on the way through, you get the opportunity to both savor and digest. And so I think what I'm talking about is reflective reading. And often with a book, whether it's a hardback or a paperback, I like to flick back, particularly if you're in the middle of a Russian novel and you want to check on those names to make sure that they all make sense and they come together. So my six suggestions, if you're looking to take something to the beach with you or you're stuck at an airport waiting for the next delayed plane, covers this week a combination of history, biography, memoir, a thriller, and a novel. And I'm going to first start with Evan Thomas's Ike's Bluff. This is the story of the Eisenhower years, the Eisenhower presidency, and the title really is a clue to understanding the book. Not many people know this, but when he was a officer cadet at West Point, Eisenhower was a great poker player, and in fact he had to stop playing because he's winning so much money from his comrades. And when he became president during the very early years of the Cold War, part of his success was bluff. In other words, he knew through the U-2 flights what the Soviets had in terms of weaponry. And again, when it came to the biggest risk of them all in 1953, the ending of the Korean War, again, he bluffed that they would consider using nuclear bombs. So Evan Thomas has put together a very lively, a kind of revisionist history of Eisenhower, and has really changed the image of the man who ran around in a golf cart and became like everybody's best favorite uncle. Well worth reading and very different. By contrast, I moved on to Pico Iyer, who is a travel writer, something of a Buddhist, and his slim book called The Man Within My Head is really a tribute to the British writer Graham Greene. He's travelled to many of the places that Greene went to. Greene, of course, gave us The Quiet American, that movie The Third Man. And I think Pico Iyer has, in a strange way, been obsessed with the way a writer can become almost a second father. So I would highly recommend this to anybody who's looking for a combination of travel, of memoir, and in some sense, a personal history. A great writer, clearly written, entertaining. Now, by way of contrast, and it is now out and available, is Christopher Hitchens' Mortality. And I interviewed Hitch when he was at Berkeley a few years ago. He was always a fun person to get into a row with. I think he operated on the premise that if two people agree, one of them is superfluous. So as a natural argumented type of person, this is a story about dying. In fact, the essays first appeared in Vanity Fair. He'd already been diagnosed with cancer. And as a professional atheist, he has put together a truly inspiring set of thoughts where you don't feel morbid, you feel sad at his loss, but at the same time you get some wonderful insights. The book is written with dignity, it's written with humour, there is really no remorse. And I think at the end you feel in such a strange way that this was a life well lived. And there was a tribute which comes at the end from his wife, Carol, a very moving tribute. And I think it does give you insights on Hitch himself. It certainly speaks about his own hero, which was George Orwell. And it's something that I think you can read without necessarily having to fear that this is a book about death. So as I would say to Hitch, see you on the other side. Now, if we're talking about death, Hilary Mantel's book, which is a sequel to her Booker Award winner, set once again in the reign of Henry VIII, which is Bring Up the Bodies. And this is an interesting perspective on the downfall of Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn, you may remember, was the second wife of Henry VIII after Catherine of Aragon had been divorced. She would end up in the Tower of London on the chopping block, executed. But behind that, and certainly the subtext deals effectively with Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell was Henry's main minister throughout this period. So this is the Machiavellian world of Tudor intrigue and conspiracy. And although it falls into the genre of historical fiction, she has done such excellent research that you really feel that you're there actually in the Tower waiting for the execution. You're sitting at Hampton Court. You're taking part in some of the great feasts and festivities. And in fact, you're listening to the music and period of the time. Great piece of historical fiction, Henry Mantel, and the sequel to her previous one called Wolf Hall, the title Bring Up the Bodies. Now, for something lighter, taken to a different direction, it's a murder story. It's called Sleight of Hand. It's by Philip Margolian, and it's a cracking tale, a sort of legal thriller, where the actual defence counsel is a conjurer, hence the title Sleight of Hand. And the magic he works is not only in court, but it's also there in the dock when he's defending or prosecuting prisoners. It's got a lot of fun, cynical sense of humour. Lawyers may have to raise an eyebrow, but I've never met a lawyer who shouldn't raise an eyebrow. And this one will give you insights as to how the court system works. And finally, a book that takes us back to Cambodia, a young writer, Vadi Ratna. It's called In the Shadow of the Banyan. And it really covers the years when the Khmer Rouge were running a very vigorous and certainly cruel genocide seen through the eyes of a five-year-old. Lyrically written, a little slow, but well worth putting together. So those then are my six choices for summer reads. Something very different with Evan Thomas and Ike's Bluff. Sleight of Hand, an interesting thriller. Christopher Hitchens, Mortality. And The Man Within My Head by Pico Iyer. And then two very different books, Hilary Mantel, Bring Up the Bodies, and finally In the Shadow of the Banyan by Vadi Ratna.
Thank you so much, Peter Robinson. That's a great list.
Thank you.
And that'll take up the rest of the
summer. We can also say welcome to you to Open Air.
Special thanks to Open Air producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Eric Jansen for making today's show possible. I'm Sarah Cahill. A reminder that you can hear this or any recent editions of Open Air at our website, kalw.org. David LaTulipe will be back next week for Open Air. Thank you very much for listening.
Steady job, but he wants to be a paperback writer. Paperback writer. It's a thousand pages, give or take a few. I'll be writing more in a week or two. I could make it longer if you like to start. I could change it round, and I want to be a paperback writer. Paperback writer.